All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is that podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight is a bit of an election night special, and we figured that this choice of movie is appropriate no matter the victor in this upcoming election, assuming that we even know who will have become the victor on that very night. So this is going to be our episode on The Purge. You can find the show notes and more for this at actualanarchy.com/205, as this is the 205th episode of the show. And Robert, I want to check in with you and just ask you, like my Facebook asks me almost every day, or every time I even scroll or look at anything, are you registered to vote? And do you know where your polling location is and in the most important election of our lifetime?
Chickity check in on Robert time. It is no, none of that, Daniel. I got a ballot in the mail. I heard that all Washingtonians vote by mail this year, so I don't know if that's true, but they did. The GOV overlord sent me a piece of paper that I'm supposed to write on and send back to them with my preferred overlord. Yeah, I don't really do that sort of thing. Not that I don't necessarily have a preferred overlord, I suppose, in the Walter Block preference equation. I just prefer to not endorse one of these monsters. Not that I think that there isn't, you know, one monster's better than the other, but you know, just because one guy is better than another doesn't mean the whole thing is garbo. And I don't think you can really vote your way to freedom. That's just the opposite. Government is the antithesis. Force and violence and the monopoly on violence is the antithesis to liberty. So if you're voting for politicians to grant you freedom, I think you're doing it wrong. You can, obviously, Ron Paul style, you know, use it as a platform to get your message out. You could even get in there and then just spout liberty 24/7, educate the whole time, but understand that you're not going to be able to really accomplish much in terms of actual granting freedom. I mean, you can try and repeal and stuff as much as possible, but there's always going to be those voters that want the government to do more. There are always going to be those special interest groups that want the government to address this thing or that thing, or to enact this regulation on their competitors, or to enact this law to protect this group. It's an endless series of special interests and vocal minorities that get the attention of the politicians, and the state, you know, loves to respond to those groups because it inflates the importance of the state. So it kind of gives it legitimacy. And you know all these arguments. I'm kind of just giving a primer on, you know, election time stuff. So I still am entertained by it. I love, you know, I still think that, you know, Inslee is a piece of garbage. He obviously deserves to lose, but I don't think that necessarily that Culp is going to do a whole lot. Although he, you know, for even the things that he said, he deserves to win, if that makes any sense. You know, he has said that it's not his job as governor to tell other people how to run their businesses and run their lives. Now, that's rhetoric, but it's nice rhetoric if he really means it. And if he can actually, you know, influence the government to move in that direction, great. But that doesn't change a whole bunch of people's minds about the need for government. and that government's actually a bad thing. Maybe a little bit, but I don't think it ultimately changes. I just see way too many Republicans and conservatives, and there is a distinction there, thinking that we absolutely do need a state. It just needs to be somewhat smaller, whatever that means. You know, they don't even really fight for the things that they actually claim to be about. So I love Trump in that he's a big middle finger to the establishment, that he calls out the fake news media, who are absolutely horrific. They do nothing but lie and obfuscate and tell partial truths and are just partisan hacks through and through. So that's nice. So, and then there's a part of me that always likes rooting for the underdog, and Trump just has that underdog cachet. He just always has. He's even though he's a billionaire, he doesn't seem to be as much of a establishment, you know, swampy hack guy. Although I saw one of his latest rallies. I don't remember where it was, Michigan, I think, maybe. I don't know. He's been flying all around. But he's been really pushing this anti-China rhetoric about how China's just been screwing over the United States and how they're just evil. And he's really almost kind of, I mean, he's probably meaning that he wants to have a better trade deal or whatever that means, you know, a whole bunch of tariffs on Chinese imports, which just screws over consumers. But it's protectionism for the producers here, so they like that. But it's really kind of it seems to me something that could be easily turned into war drumbeats. I don't know if that's the way he wants it, but I could see a bunch of war hawks kind of jumping on board this anti-China rhetoric and going, "Yeah, these guys are evil. We need to start some shit with these guys. We gotta put them down with the hand of God." So I think it's not great. I don't really get why he's doing it, especially when he's been generally so good about peace. Generally, I mean, he's not like a principled libertarian ANCAP person or even any kind of a pacifist. But anyway, I don't know, man. What are your, you got some of the thoughts here? I'm just rambling at this point.
Well, I'm actually doing a bit of an inside joke for myself, just seeing as how far I'll let you go on your Robert's Rants here. So this has been Robert's Rants, episode number one. You can find the show notes and more for that at trubster.com/1. And Robert's Rants will be a new show that he doesn't even know that he's going to be starting. But you can find the show notes and more for our Actual Anarchy show at actualanarchy.com/205. And before we go much further, I think we need to introduce our guest. And I will give you my take on elections and what I think is going to happen. And we will get that from our guest as well as we get into the last night's portion of the show, talking about The Purge right after these messages. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Robert Paul Johnson, and we are The Last Nighters. You can find us on the Launchpad Media, where they're always launching new ideas in your direction, and also at lastnighters.com. This is going to be episode 148 of the show, and we're going to be talking about The Purge as our election night or election week episode. So you can find the show notes more at lastnighters.com/148. We have some pre-show content already in place, and Robert goes on a pretty lengthy rant. He might even start a show out of it. He doesn't know that yet, but he might. Called Robert's Rants, and you can get that at our Patreon, lastnighters.com/Patreon. Throw a couple dollars our way, and we will give you access to all sorts of things that you probably didn't even know you wanted. So with that enticing introduction, I also want to introduce you to our guest tonight. He is a multi-time guest on the show. He was on most recently, I believe, for Snowpiercer, and before that was Spirited Away, the Miyazaki movie, right? And then you were on for the Robert the Bruce movie, right? Whatever that one was called. The Outlaw King. That's right. So, yes, it's the based Swede, the anarcho-Viking, Olaf, joining us once again. Welcome back to the show, Olaf.
Great to be here again from the heart of Winter Park.
All right, yeah, he's in a swing state, everyone. We were talking about that in the pre-show. So we'll get your take on the election as we discuss The Purge. And one of the reasons we chose The Purge is because I figured that no matter who ends up the victor, whether we know on election night or not, there's going to be a whole swath of people who are upset. Now, if it goes one direction, I think that the people who are going to be upset are going to be more violence in the streets type, like Purge style. And then the other side, I'm not sure exactly what might happen, but I think it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks. And recently, our man, Turning the Frogs Gay, Alex Jones, was on with Joe Rogan, episode 1555, talking about the 79 days of hell that he expected right after the election up until Inauguration Day, because he figured that no matter what the outcome, if it's not a clear Biden victory on election night, then they're going to contest it and fight it. All the way through to January and have this go through the courts and the Democratic Party, you know, they are a party of lawyers. And so they kind of have an advantage there. But anyway, I digress a little bit, but welcome back to the show. We will have all of the prior appearances that you were on with us on our show notes page. Do you have any projects or anything you want to mention before we get into the movie?
No, I mean, that just, whenever I was on the previous appearances, like that's it. You can link to those because those were also worthwhile discussions about important movies.
Yes. Yes. I really enjoyed them. I remember my wife watches these live. And when you were on for Outlaw King, it was like almost 2 years ago now, I think. She was like, yeah, you guys really had a good rapport, you know? And I think I mentioned that in the post show, like, hey man, you should, you know, do your own show or something.
Yeah, right. No, that hasn't happened, but you know, I'll keep thinking about it. No, yeah, that's very nice of her to say. No, but it was a good movie. So I credit the movie to, you know, some things you can say a lot about, and some things there's not so much to say about. So,
right, yeah, well said. And I know that you've also been doing a lot of updates on Sweden, as you're originally from Sweden, and how it relates to the current pandemic and how it's being misconstrued in media and presented in media in a certain bent, shall we say, as you've done a lot of long posts about that. I've also seen you on A Neighbor's Choice, the David. How do you say his name? Is it Gornowski?
Gornowski. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been on there for about two or three times, I think. And he's doing a radio, his live radio show from Florida. So it's on WFM FLA Orlando. Can't remember exactly which frequency, but it's a neighbor's choice. If you Google that, it'll get to the website and all the archived stuff is there. So you can find my appearances there too.
Okay, I'll find those and put it on the show notes page as well. And then I've also heard his show being advertised on the great Dave Smith's Part of the Problem.
Yeah.
So anyway, big influences all around. And thanks again for joining us. And as you know, how we usually start these things off is with the old Google description. So I will pull that up now. And away we go. So The Purge came out 2013 and has spawned several prequels and sequels and whatnot. I think there's one more coming out next year. Rated R horror/thriller, and it's an hour and 25 minutes in length. The IMDb is 5.7 out of 10, 40% Rotten Tomatoes, 41% Metacritic, and 85% of Google users liked it. It did make a fair amount of money, and that's why they keep making more of these things. And as we had discussed, Olaf, in the pre-show, that it's not necessarily a good movie per se, but it does have a lot of interesting discussion points, and that will be the basis for tonight. So the description is, in an America ravaged by crime and overcrowded prisons, the government sanctions an annual 12-hour period during which all criminal activity, including murder, is legal. James Sandin, played by our man from Training Day, Ethan Hawke, and his family face the ultimate test when an intruder drags the vicious outside world into their home. James, Mary, played by Queen Circe, and their two children struggle to survive the night while trying not to turn into monsters like the ones they are striving to avoid. The release date was May 31st, 2013. Director is James DeMonaco. He also did the screenplay. He wrote the screenplays for all of the movies, including the one yet to come. And there's even a television series. And I think he at least did the pilot episode for that. Budget of only $3 million. And I think that they cleared over $100 million on this thing. So they did pretty well with this. And Robert, I'll go to you for your opening on The Great Purge from 2013.
Ooh, The Great Purge, huh? Oh, I see. Just enabling white supremacists over here. All right. So this is one of those high concept, low budget, you know, people just getting started in Hollywood. They got an idea and they can scrap another money together to make basically what is a pilot movie. It's, you know, it looks pretty bad, especially when all the lights go out and then it's like Blair Witch Project. But, you know, the acting is competent. I mean, Cersei Lannister lady, she is great. I mean, she doesn't get a whole lot to do here. She's way better. You got way more meat on Game of Thrones. And then help me with the main guy again, Ethan Hawke, right?
You are correct, sir.
Yes, Ethan Hawke. Yeah, he was okay. I mean, he's not the world's greatest actor, but he, you know, did fine enough job for what he had to do. He was basically played statist concerned dad for the most part. But what I liked most about this movie, and probably what helped it get made, was the concept. It is a bunch of flawed statist capitalists as the heroes, getting attacked by a bunch of statist commies as the villains, and the capitalists kill the commies. So, I mean, what's not to love about this movie, honestly? When it came time for the justification of why people were purging, and, you know, there's a bit of psychology thrown in, I kind of appreciated that. I don't agree with it at all. I don't think that human beings can just store up all their anger and hatred and animosity all year and then cathartically release it by killing, you know, random guy or even the target of your ire, and then have everything be peaceful after that. I think, as we've talked about, you used to talk about more on the show, but not so much lately because it's kind of, you know, old news. But, you know, solving your problems with violence just creates more problems. And the movie does try to, like, has a psychologist come on and talk about how everybody cathartically killing and then just, you know, getting it out of your system, basically. But once you go around killing all these people, all you're going to do is create a whole ton of resentment. The people in the movie, it only works if everybody in the world is a psychopath and can't empathize with all the people. And it's very much the case with the characters in the beginning of the movie. Like, the kind of the arc of the heroes is that they're very much pro purge. And then they kind of learn that, oh, gee, when it happens to you, it's kind of sucks. And, oh, these people that are dying are actually people too. And I mean, they kind of know that because they're adults, but then they also go longer. They believe the propaganda that it needs to happen for a better world. It's an individualist versus collectivist argument. It's a capitalist versus communist argument, because the main characters sell these systems, these security systems, and the enemies, the villains, are people that think you should have given it to us for free. And so I thought it was great. I thought that, you know, it was high concept. It was a high concept. I wouldn't say it's a horror movie, and it wouldn't even say it's a thriller either, because we didn't really get to know the main characters enough to care about them when they were getting killed and in danger and stuff. I was like, yeah, go ahead, kill them. Go ahead. I really don't care. I don't give a shit about these people. But I mean, I was with them in terms of the argument. I just didn't think the movie gave me enough emotional reason to like and care about them. But overall, I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with this one.
Okay. Yeah. You know, it's funny. My wife, when we were watching, she's like, I know Robert's going to say they didn't develop the characters enough. I don't care if these people die.
That's right. So she was absolutely right.
She called it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, just my initial take on what you're saying is, I think that it's maybe a caricature of quote unquote capitalists that they're sort of presenting here. And the argument that they're selling a, they're overselling a shoddy product with marketing speak, and that they're upset that he's making all this money selling these shoddy systems that aren't all that effective. And I don't know if like the neighbors are necessarily like aware of the systems being just good enough, but they are upset that he's made enough money to be able to like build an addition onto their fancy house and whatnot. So there's a lot of like jealousy going on, like keeping up with the Joneses style, a lot of, you know, my neighbor's got it better than me, so therefore I hate him, that kind of a thing. But, you know, I mean, overall, I agree. I think the concept is pretty interesting, and it is a bit of a thought experiment. I do recall in my psychology college courses that we did talk about catharsis and how there's the idea that that releasing something can be beneficial, but that overall, I believe that the studies at the time indicated that it wasn't like a long lasting thing. And so my take on that would just be, well, people are either going to use that opportunity to be even more violent than they would have otherwise been over the course of, you know, their average, you know, lifetime normally, or they would, you know, save up these aggressions or these grievances to then exact these revenges. And as they get further into the series, I just watched the second one the other night. It seemed to be now they're presenting in the second one that it's really just a population control measure to eliminate the poor classes so that the government doesn't have to support them anymore monetarily with programs and whatnot.
So the poor people would want to purge the rich people, but because of the security systems, they can't? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there's a disparity. There's an inequality in that the rich can afford protection or weapons, so therefore they can be the aggressors and the poor are defenseless. And in fact, in the second one, this old man who's got a terminal condition, he sells himself to these rich people who ritualistically purge him, and they agree to pay his heirs a certain amount of money for him doing that. And I was like, hey, you know, it's all above board as far as I'm concerned. Like, he agreed to do it, they agreed to pay, and he was going to die anyway. Who am I to tell him he can't do that? But anyway, we're here to talk about the first movie. But that's just, you know, so my initial reply to you. And then Olaf, do you have any take on the Google description, anything Robert said, or just anything that you took from the movie that you would like to bring out for discussion here?
Checkmate ANCAP lolbertarians. Like, you see what happens when you let the state police stand down? Like, everybody's just going to go out killing each other. We have to rethink our entire philosophy. This does not work.
Owned.
It's anarchy out there. Like, look, just 12 hours of anarchy. Look what it creates. All this chaos and murder and destruction and everything. No, I mean, it was kind of funny like that, but no, I think, I didn't like the movie primarily because I thought it was so highly predictable. Everything was extremely predictable from the first events with the boyfriend managing to break into the house. Like, we knew that the dad was not going to die there. We knew that if, you know, that he weren't going to be the one who had to go. Like, there were these serious events, and it was not a surprise at all in any way that the homeless dude gets to be, you know, the hero of the day, pretty much. Everything was predictable in a very trivial way, which kind of made it almost boring. It became boring, I think, in that sense. Although there are a lot of topics to extrapolate from. I do think that there is, yeah, like I said this in the beginning, but before the show started, in the pre-content, I think it has a pretty intense pagan spin to it with the sacrificial habits and the sort of the intense desire to cleanse yourself in a way through sacrifice. I mean, that's very much in the pagan spirit, you know, Because if you, you look at what René Girard, who's an author and founder of something called the mimetic theory, and how there's always a scapegoat that has to be sacrificed in order to maintain peace of society. This has a lot of elements that you can draw parallels from his works, and seeing that, you know, this specific family, the protagonists, like they said themselves, the kid asked, well, why aren't you doing this? And they said, well, we don't have the need to do this. Well, that's Girard's argument. When Jesus Christ dies on the cross, he is the ultimate sacrifice that will end all this pagan savage behavior to bring peace to the world. And there are interesting things like that to strike from. But that was my impression. That has a big pagan spin to it, and also reminds me a little bit of like the Hunger Games. Like why they're doing this? They're the same motivations and the same arguments, but because we have to carry on civilizations. It's part of our history now. It's like this sick ritual that they keep repeating. It's a hive mentality and like a scapegoat mentality that we have to sacrifice something in order for peace to be maintained. Yeah. It's very pagan.
Yeah, I like that take. Do you think that's intentional or is that just coincidental based on?
I think it's part of the sick habits that are going on in Hollywood. I mean, they seem to be on a pagan streak like for the last few decades, you know, and I think that reflects in the movies that come out of there, and in also some of the stuff that probably goes on in there as well.
Right.
So it doesn't surprise me that this would shine through in some of these films that you see. I don't know if that's, you know, intentional or if it's a coincidence, but it very much reflects somehow the, I don't know. There is something about the way they want to express human nature as this, this really evil, and kind of alternative spiritual thing that plays in it all. It's an interesting, very twisted, sick, stuff, but, definitely worth talking about.
Right. Yeah. I think you're right that they are basically assuming that the nature of man is evil and that this is an opportunity for them. And they also liken it to being patriotic. And so they use it almost like it's a bit of a religious fervor. Like they make it a patriotic duty and a right, a positive right that you on this night can go and kill whoever you want, and it's like it's almost like this is going to get us deplatformed, but like the right to choose, right? Like we have a right to do this thing that we want to do to you know, like mitigate consequences for our actions, things like that. So and it also brings up the whole idea of like, well, just because something's legal doesn't mean that it's right. So there's like natural law and negative rights, right? Negative rights are the only rights that truly can exist because everyone can exercise them all equally and at the same time without infringing on another. Positive rights implies that you can do something to someone else against their will or force them to provide a good or a service to you against their will. So there's just a big difference. And I'll go to Robert because I know you got a big rant in you about just because something is legal or lawful doesn't mean that it's actually morally correct or something that is justified in any way. Like they're just writing down things on paper and saying they're basically defying the reality of a situation because they wrote something on paper.
Yeah, no, for sure. No, if we could just write down enough laws, we could have our own perfect society as if that's how that works. The idea that, I mean, this is a very religious film, like you guys were saying. There's even, you know, all the ritualistic killing. Like you're killing for the collective, for the state, kind of like the glorification of the nation as a whole. Like you're doing your, like you said, Daniel, your patriotic duty to be a good citizen, to release this animalistic anger and violence out. And this is why people go to gyms in the real world. This is why people do jujitsu, why they go running, why they do boxing. There are many constructive ways, actually, of releasing any kind of pent-up aggression. You're angry about something, you can turn it into a constructive way. You could build something. You could start a new project. You could do any number of things. But the main, it was funny in the very end of the film, what struck me the most as the most religious thing was they're all sitting around this table and they're just waiting for the magical time to appear, as if they're just waiting for the sign from their God for it to be 7 o'clock in the morning. And then as if everybody just magically agrees that the purging is over and all what happened on the purge stays in the purge. And there's just not going to be, you know, we're back to being normal human beings. And it absolutely assumes that these characters are all sociopaths and that they don't carry the resentment from the last year's purge with them the whole rest of the year. Like there wouldn't be revenge killings throughout the year. A lot of murders are done as crimes of passion. They're not necessarily premeditated, you know, super criminal crimes where you're going to plot out exactly how you're going to get away with it and stuff. That's why a lot of criminals are just caught, because you're just in the moment and you're pissed and shit's going down and you're not thinking about how you're putting on gloves and going to dust everything off afterwards. And I mean, you may clean up things afterwards, but it's messy because human beings react in a very sudden way when they see an injustice. Now I know a lot of people are conditioned to like call the cops and that sort of thing, but when you are in a situation where you are going to take justice into your own hands, you will do so quickly and just without even really thinking about it, because you are seeing an injustice and you are going to rectify that.
Can I interject a little here?
Yeah, please.
So we open the film on these mostly peaceful protests at the very beginning of the movie, kind of opening this. And sort of what you're talking about is, you know, people taking justice into their own hands. Well, it's even more amplified now as the police have kind of stood down against these mostly peaceful protests. And in fact, there's riots in Philadelphia right now, only you wouldn't know about it because they're not talking about it in the mainstream media. And I think it's because it doesn't poll well for the election for one team over the other. Mm-hmm, And I forget where I was going with this exactly, but let's see. Remind me the last thing you were saying.
Talk about the immediacy of extracting justice when you see an injustice. You want to correct it immediately.
Oh, right.
And if you find yourself to be the only one capable of doing that, then you will act. So, I mean, if you walk in on your wife cheating on you, you might, you know, pull out a gun and start blasting. You're not necessarily going to plan the perfect murder, walk out and then calm down and plan the perfect murder. You're in that moment. You're riled up. You are enraged at this event that you are witnessing.
Right. Yeah. And if you were to premeditate, then make sure that you bring gloves that are too small so that then later you can claim that they don't fit. So therefore you couldn't have been you. See, I picked up something in the early 90s.
You learned.
Let loose the juice. But the other thing related to, you mentioned these crimes happening, and this is statistics well before current year. It's current year, you know. Come on, man, it's current year. But I think something along the lines of almost half of all violent crime doesn't even get reported to the police. I've got the statistics somewhere, and it's probably from 2015, 2016, something like that. So you can only imagine how much different it is now when the police have essentially been told to stand down in a lot of these cities. So it's not even worth reporting these things, even more so than in years past. So you could probably see a lot of this stuff sort of happening with more people being self-reliant on their own defense. It's kind of what I'm driving at here.
Fantastic.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, we sort of talked about, he sells these security systems and apparently, you know, he has to admit to his wife, Circe, that they're not actually going to be able to prevent the polite stranger from his gang of people breaking into the house. And really, it's just a matter of, like, their security systems are almost security theater. Like they need to look imposing and be a bit of a deterrent so that they make other targets more appealing. So it's like, you know, it's just to, you only have to be faster than the next guy. You don't need to be faster than the bear. You just need to be faster than that other guy that the bear is also chasing.
Yeah, I thought the wife's criticism was ridiculous. She was like, I mean, I know he probably had to have a character say that in the film. Like, oh, what? This isn't actually impregnable? And it's like, and then his advice, his response was, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's not like we're building the house out of diamond. It's, you know, they could get cars, they could get chains, they could pull on it, they could go through the cracks. I mean, you're multiplying the security, but you're not making it impregnable to a, you know, a massively determined attacker. This is why it's important to also be armed, which they were. This is why, you know, it's important to have friends in the neighborhood, which supposedly they were, but clearly that all goes away on Purge Night or whatever. I did appreciate. Now, this is what I kind of want to get into a little bit with you guys. Because a big plot point in the film, of course, is the movie starts off with a kid kind of doing something stupid. He's like, actually still has empathy. And he sees this guy being a fool. And he's like, yo, come on in. And so the dude comes in, he, without consulting anybody else, he just acts, right? He sees an injustice and he acts. He sees that he's able to help somebody and he hasn't been propagandized out of doing that action yet. So he does that, even though it's probably stupid, but the plot has to happen. So then these like American Psycho kids all come up and they're like, yo, dude, we totally see these flowers that knows that you're, that means you're signaling to us that you're totally down with what we're doing. And so you're one of us. This is great. Fantastic. We love you. Fantastic. Keep up the good job. But you've got this homeless scum that we were about to get our murder on with. You need to let us have him or else we're going to do to you what we're going to do to him. And the main character, I know he has to have an arc. So I'm on board with him having an arc. He's not a perfect protagonist. At first, he's like, okay, I'm going to protect my family and I'm going to get this guy out of here and give him away. And then, like, his wife is like, look at us, look at what we're doing to him. And then he's like, oh, yeah, totally. I still totally get what we're doing to him. And like, okay, this, he sees the light now. And he goes, okay, now we're going to fight. And of course, if you're going to fight, and I would have fought instantly. I don't know about you guys, but I would have been like, yeah, screw you. I'm now, I got one extra guy in here to help me fight you guys. So that's just how I roll. You're coming up to me with this energy saying that I got to be a bitch and bow down to you or else you're going to attack me. I don't think so, buddy. I got guns too. Let's see what happens. And I'm on the defensive side. I know my space and it's going to be dark and we're going to be setting traps. So good luck. That's what I was saying.
You're the Alamo. It's like a 10-to-1 ratio and a defensive to offensive.
Yeah.
You know, casualty rate.
And I know it's not a perfect setup for defense, but he does have second story windows. He could have had rifles out the second story windows. Why he didn't do that, I don't know. Movie has to happen, I suppose. He could also had a rifle out the mail slot. You know, whatever. You could break out a window, start gunning some fools down. You know, all these ideas that I would have done from a defensive, like minded strategist position. But yeah, what did you guys think of the, hey, this guy's got to go? Were you super upset with the main character? Would you have just gone instantly with me and been like, no, fuck you. We're throwing down. Or would you have been like, yo, I got a duty to protect my family here and I'm calculating the odds. And I think that the odds are better to save my children if I give this guy away. Now, ultimately he goes, nah, screw it. This is our home. This is where our children live. We're going down in a blaze of glory if we're going down. But what did you guys think of that process? Were you more sympathetic to the, hey, let's go ahead and take care of the homeless guy? Olaf, what do you think first, buddy?
Well, it's a moral dilemma, and I was looking at this movie, a lot of things in it, and I was looking at it from, because I come from a Christian perspective on this, and the the thing that strikes me, like, among you, you don't get introduced to a lot of characters. So that's the first thing. But the thing that you get introduced to is that this family and these people living in this house has some kind of moral conscience. They still have empathy for people, and that differentiates them. And they don't have the need to go out and do the sacrificial kind of ritual like everybody else. And then they're sort of like come to their senses, right? They're like, well, what are we doing? What is this? Is not us. This, we're not the pagans here. We, you know, we are better than this. You know, that's the thing. That so I actually like that twist to it. I like that that they did not throw that guy out to the savages out there to just ritually slaughter him in some sick twisted way, which they said have acknowledged themselves that we don't need to be part of this, but we kind of have this still like this collective. They're not completely detached from it because they are supportive of the whole thing going on. Just like many people who are, you know, Christians in the United States today are still like completely attached to, yeah, but we're still supportive of some, you know, all of these things that the government is doing here and there, you know, when it comes to, you know, like supporting Israel or you know, messing up the Middle East. Hey, you know, we got to do kind of thing. But you can see that there is a conflict there going on, a mental like struggle for them too. And when they sort of come to these realizations and changes their way of looking at the situation and turns to say, okay, yeah, no, we're not doing this, and we're gonna go and fight the Satanists outside as opposed to throwing this innocent guy out to them. So I actually like that. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I think that, he wasn't really in a position to be the moral actor as far as he was threatened and his whole family was threatened. And this was an accepted practice, not saying that it's a right practice, but all of the participants bought into the propaganda, at least leading into this confrontation. And so it's almost like there was a gun to his head and the way out was, we'll give up this guy and the family will be spared. And so I sort of was like kind of okay with that level of it because he wasn't doing it of his own free will, right? He was like, do this or we'll kill you.
Right. Gun to your head, gun to your balls. You got, it's a bad situation either way. You're not the moral actor. So I'm not necessarily going to judge him if he does give up the guy.
Right. But the thing that didn't work for me in this was when he did decide, okay, you know what, we're going to stay and fight. Then he didn't have the conversation with the guy like, hey, I was wrong. We are not going to give you up. But here's the thing we're going to do. We're going to fight. So we're going to release you and let's get a defensive position set up. Let's come up with a quick strategy, you know, like strategy session, real, you know, 10 second one. You go here, you go here, you go here. Triangle of fire, defensive positions at all egress points, whatever. But no, he leaves him tied up. And then Cersei just goes wandering around in the dark with a gun. Ethan Hawke goes wandering around in the dark with a gun. And yeah, I get it. You want to have like some tension and like what's behind him and, oh, they don't see the guy and whatever. And it's movie making, but you know, you got to assume that your audience isn't totally stupid, right? Like, okay. Yeah. Oh, she can't see the masked person behind him. That's been done before a million times, you know, 80s slasher movies. You don't need that here. What you need here is smart, you know, like, hey, we've made this decision now. Now let's implement something and let's get the audience watching this like down with, okay, we're going to fucking fight back, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, well,
go
I just to push on this point that you're making, you can have plenty of tension. I know they were doing it for dramatic effect, you know, having these like people running around in the dark and they had a low budget. You know, and they're kind of playing up on this, what you don't see is more terrifying than what you do see. And it's a Blair Witch kind of a thing. But you can have, and I know maybe it's not the movie they wanted to make. They wanted to make kind of a slasher, thriller, gorier movie. But to your idea that, you know, they implement a strategy and I think the tension would have been a lot higher if you don't hate the main characters for being dumb. So yeah, they would have gotten in defensive positions, and then you could still be overwhelmed and outnumbered, and there's still a lot of dramatic tension that way. I mean, I think there's all kinds of Last Stand kind of movies that have been successful. I mean, Lord of the Rings, Two Towers with the Battle of Helm's Deep. You've got like the Alamo. I'm sure there's all kinds of things I can't think of right now, but all kinds of movies where you're vastly outnumbered. You're ragtag. Yeah. Yeah. There you go. Seven Samurai.
Bug's Life.
The Last Samurai. Tons of movies are, you know, small band of desperate defenders against overwhelming odds. So you could have, I know it's been done, obviously, but this is a different take on that kind of a story, and you could have done it your own way. It would be kind of, a Waco situation where you've got people invading a home and you are defending it. And that would have been maybe a different movie than they wanted to make, but I think it would have been better for audience engagement and tension-wise to portray the characters as a desperate team doing the best they can to fight off against overwhelming odds.
Right. Like they sent the son with a gun to the laundry room, and then, you know, he's there with a flashlight giving away his position. Like,
yes, that like, was just, let's all spread out and split up. Cause that makes sense.
Anyway, Olaf, I know you were about to jump in and we probably kept going and you probably lost your train of thought, but.
I was going to say that he didn't have control over anybody. Right. So everybody, it was like, Each for their own kind of thing. Like each person went off on their own. And then when one of them found himself in trouble, somebody else just magically appeared and last second just killed the guy who was about to kill them.
Yeah, they happened again and again.
Yeah, I hated again, that. Yeah,
like every single time. They didn't have control. Really, nobody knew where another person was. There was no coordination, team coordination in any way whatsoever. And it's just like by pure luck, when they were about to get slashed in the head by an axe or something, that the other person comes out there in the door and like blows the head off of that person who was about to kill him last second. And that happened.
That was really frustrating to have them to be like, I'm going to get you. And then, he's shot in the back. Okay. I got it. Yeah. But yeah. To have the main characters have this darkened house, you know, it's, there's the movie, what's that movie, Daniel? Don't Breathe, where there's a group of invaders in a house and there's this blind guy, or he's deaf and blind. He's deaf and blind, or deaf at least. I think he's just blind, right?
Yeah, he could hear him. And he could, that's why they couldn't breathe.
Yeah, that's right. He could hear him. So he's walking around the house. He knows every inch of that house. And, you know, he's terrifying, right? To these ragtag invader people. It could have been a really fun tables turn kind of a situation where you lure in these invaders into your home, and then
you know the lay of the land.
You turn off all the lights on purpose, and you set up ambushes for these assholes. And you know, instead of them coming in and it being I know they wanted to make a horror movie, but like I said, the horror didn't work in this movie. It didn't. It just, the tension didn't work. So I think you would have been better off. I hate it when a reviewer rewrites the movie. Well, I don't necessarily hate it, but you know, review the movie for what it is. I still enjoyed it, but I think it would have been more fun.
I think there's some things you could have done to make this an amazing movie. And it's just this simple stuff that we're talking about, you know, like leave some tension in there, have them come up with a plan, do an Alamo situation, do a lay the land, you know, set traps kind of thing, you know, Revolutionary War style, Patriot style. You know, they knew what the British didn't know. And so they were able to outflank them and pick them off, sort of guerrilla war style.
Right. But, and they're a more determined enemy because they're defending their homeland. Right. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of angles you can go on that. Let's see. Oh yeah, so I did have a question.
Or you could stand there and go, look, a homeless guy is running back around there. I think I see one. We're going to run by. Go get him. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Now, speaking of the homeless guy that they take in, when I first read about the sequel to this, I noticed that there was the same character or same actor in it, but I didn't know the actor's name or who he was. So I thought it was the creepy head of the gang. The well-polished,
the American Psycho kid. Yeah.
American Psycho kid. And I think they totally wasted him. Like he had he had a certain look and a certain like persona that I think could have been really, really well played on. Like, I think that he was creepy initially, but then they just like kill him off very, very weakly. Like he's about to like kill them, but he has to, you know, monologue for a second. So, you know, of course he gets killed by the neighbors. But anyway, I had thought that the sequel was going to be the events leading up to this homeless guy arriving at their house. And I thought that would be fucking awesome. Let's see that gang with that American Psycho kid. The whole movie is how they got into chasing that guy and injuring him and how he escaped to this neighborhood. And that leads directly into this movie. But no, the sequel is almost totally detached from this one. It's a year later, and that same actor is actually the guy who was the homeless guy, and now he's part of the resistance or whatever. So missed opportunity.
Missed opportunity for sure. That main American Psycho kid is probably the most dynamic character in the movie. He is menacing. He's almost cartoonishly menacing, but I thought he did a really good job, and he could have been like the face of the Purge. I mean, based on how they want to run this series, I guess, I don't know. They had different ideas, but
yeah. And I'm surprised they didn't have him do the, you know, the villain, is he dead? You know, come back and get you, you know, I mean, that's
every one of these horror movies. It's totally, or it's his twin brother that wants revenge. And now the next movie, it's the same actor, but you know,
yeah. Yeah. We got to make our own movies, buddy. Of course, if we made a movie, it would be hot garbage. We'd miss all like this stuff.
But, and where are we going to even get $3 million anyway? So,
right.
Well, I thought you guys had with this show already. You must have $3 million. Come on.
Well, all our Patreon support, lastnight.com/Patreon, everyone. And thank you so much for the support we are getting now, by the way. We do have a nice stable of patrons, and we do appreciate that you guys appreciate enough of what we do to do something to, you know, make it known. We've also been getting emails, suggestions, reviews. And actually one of the suggestions was that we read reviews, or we solicit Bill Burr style, like give us a review and just fucking trash us. Like be rude to us, like give it 5 stars and then say something like crude and funny about us. And we'll read it on air. I don't know if you, Robert, you know, the Bill Burr Monday Morning Podcast, he reads like letters from people and they call him like a fucking cunt and a douchebag and whatnot, but they're like actually, you know, big fans of his.
But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a jocular, like ribbing style. So I think we could, you know, maybe do something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, a lot of podcasts do like a hate mail segment and they're almost always the funniest segment in the show. So yeah, that'd be a lot of fun.
Babylon Bee. Have you listened to their podcast? They do.
Yeah, they recently started doing reading. Email segment. Yeah.
Some of the funniest stuff ever.
Absolutely. All right,
so leave us a rating and review on iTunes or wherever else you can do such a thing. And make sure it's 5 stars. I mean, you know, if we deserve it. But then, you know, say something funny, mean-spirited funny, and we'll read it on air. We've got, I don't know, like 20-some-odd reviews on there now. And the more reviews there are, the more other people will get suggested the show. And you know, if you do some good hilarious stuff, it might inspire others to do more. But anyway, let's get back to the movie. Olaf, did you have any notes or things that you wanted to cover before we are actually getting low on time, unfortunately?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the important thing that we should emphasize more, I think, is the play on egalitarian envy that is in there from, you know, the people in the neighborhood. And it's creepy to see, because it's not that far-fetched from reality today.
Oh yeah, yeah, because that's
how
well
people want to do with those who are much better off. There are some people out there who wouldn't hesitate to round them up and put them up against the wall. Mm-hmm. or do other things. So it's not that far-fetched at all. And it's kind of frightening how well it corresponds to, you know, this sentiment that exists in society, because people have been taught, many people from very young age, like the class analysis, not the one perhaps that we subscribe to between the predatory state and its prey, but instead it's the capitalist class versus the working class. And that is something that could turn very, very ugly, which it does in this movie. It's a prime example of that. So that's one, the type of scapegoat. They always need a scapegoat. Remember, that's the pagan ritual. So whether it's the rich capitalist or the homeless guy, see the contrast? They're both scapegoats for the ritualistic killing that exists. And it's the same type of sentiment that exists towards both of them. One is the egalitarian envy the sales man and his family and their you know, huge, humongous mansion that they live in and all their wealth that they have, and the neighbors hate them because of their wealth and success. And on the other side, you have these kids, these psycho kids, who hate this poor dirty bag because he is, you know, the scum and low kind of lower society, and they just want to purge him because of who he is. So there is two different spectrum of how you see that scapegoating mentality taking place and how it manifests itself. That I think is, that's like the most important, the most interesting part of the entire movie is to me at least is that the contrast between both of these sides are essentially ritualistic scapegoats to the masses, to the mob.
Right. And They're people that do not want to take responsibility for their own actions. So they transfer all their self-loathing and hatred on some scapegoat and then kill that person and then feel all kinds of better about themselves. But yeah, the idea that Ethan Hawke, you know, was forcing them to buy this home security system. Obviously they valued the home security system more than they valued their dollars. So to get upset at that, I mean, how they see Ethan Hawke as somebody to be murdered as opposed to someone that they are happy that is in the neighborhood because he is providing these home security systems to them for obviously a price that they can easily afford. Is just beyond. I understand it happens all the time. People resent Amazon and Walmart for making their lives better every day, but it's really on display here in this film, the scapegoating, because they just don't want to take responsibility for their own actions. That they voluntarily bought this security system, that all of a sudden now they're upset that he went and took the money that they paid for the security system and bought an addition on his house. Why would you give a shit?
Aren't they happy that they have the security system? I mean,
aren't they?
They're using it, right?
They're not the ones getting their houses invaded.
Right. And like, the imagine, other thing is,
imagine like live, because that was a wealthy neighborhood too, right? So it's like, I have two yachts and you have four or five yachts. And now I'm upset because you have five. Why can't I just go back and enjoy my two yachts that I have and live my happy life? I have to, you know, hate you. I already live in like abundant luxury. Like all of those people, you could see the neighborhood, right? Every one of those lived in a gated community in abundance of luxury. We're obviously wealthy.
To be envious of someone who has just a bit more than you when you already are in the, you know,
it's absolutely ridiculous.
What is it, the top 1% or whatever?
Top 1% for sure.
And that's an argument I think I've heard on Tom Woods. He's mentioned that, like, you know, your average Bernie voter who complains about the 99 or the 1%, you know, that they're part of the 99%. Well, they're looking at a very narrow view. If you consider, you know, there's what, over 7.5 billion people on the planet. Well, if you're making, you know, an average wage in the United States, well, guess what? Worldwide, you are the 1%. You know, and yet, you know, those are the people out there, you know, rioting and burning down cities to send a message and stimulate the economy, according to a Krugman type. So that's a lot of fun.
If you have a refrigerator, you're like in the top 50% or something like that. It's crazy. I mean, a lot of people around the world still don't necessarily have all the amenities that you even have, even the poor have here.
Right. Now, Robert, I want to mention one other missed opportunity in the writing of this movie. Mm. I thought it was foreshadowing was when that envious neighbor gave her the plate of cookies. I was like, oh, that's got to play a role later. like maybe at the end they eat the cookies or poison or whatever. Like that was her method of killing her, purging her. But no, nothing.
Yeah. And then the obvious little robot that the boy has, I thought that was going to play a bigger role, or at least a role more at the end. I mean, he uses it throughout the film a little bit, especially when the lights first go out. But I thought it was going to be more of a thing, but it didn't really turn out to be. I don't know.
Right. Any secret hiding hole?
Yeah. And it just seemed like a, you know, I mean, the guy had, I think he had a good concept for a movie, but he's not necessarily the most seasoned screenwriter. So I think if he had passed the script around to some more, you know, guys that kind of knew their chops a little bit better, they could have punched it up a bit and worked it, you know, and kind of massaged it into more of a satisfying story. But, you know, it's probably a young guy. That's just my guess. Guy that's maybe been working for a while in Hollywood, but finally has a chance to get his script made, you know, and he's just not these, you know, guy that's done it a million times. He's a first, it's probably one of his first scripts he's ever written. And for the most part, it's decent. It's we've kind of torn it apart a bit, but he had a pretty good concept and he executed it fairly well. And you know, I gotta kind of cheer on this guy. I know that the, like you say, the subsequent films turned into more of like a class warfare, but I don't know, what I don't know is what take, you know, what position the movie takes. Is it that, you know, these people, because in this film, I very much believe that it is the property rights capitalists who are the heroes in this film, and that the commies who just are the jealous, you know, kill it all, you know, ritual sacrifice, we should get shit for free, are the villains. So that's a very different position than from what I understand of the sequels. Not to say that artists don't learn new things and, you know, change their mind and, you know, explore different views in their work. But do you understand that the subsequent films to be more kind of this communistic class warfare kind of position where it's like, yeah, rich people are evil, that kind of thing?
The second one, and that's the only other one that I've seen. Yeah, it's played up a lot more, where there's actually rich people doing auctions for being able to go into a controlled environment and hunt people who have been captured off the streets and brought in to be purged. So there's very much a anti-rich message in how the rich are heartless and not humanitarian at all, treating the poor as if they are less than human.
Do you know who the main character is? Is it one of the people captured, or is it one of the people on the inside being the purgers and then he changes his mind because he realizes it's evil?
The main character, I believe, it's a bit of an ensemble, but the main character is a cop who his son had been killed by a drunk driver. And so he's been plotting his revenge for the year waiting for Purge Night. And so he goes out on Purge Night to go and, you know, exact his revenge. And along the way, he sees some innocent women fighting back, but being outnumbered, being attacked by government agents. And so he gets involved with that. And then they end up all getting rounded up and brought into this rich auction hunting man, the most dangerous game.
Okay, so he is one of the getting purged people.
Right. But he does intend to purge. He does intend to purge one person.
Okay. So he's a flawed main character then, for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, he ends up like not actually doing it, and then that guy saves his life at the end. You know, spoilers, everyone. It's spoilers all the time on this show, of course. Now, I wanted to ask, let's see, at the very end, whether counting down the clock, like you had mentioned, you know, they're just waiting till 7 a.m. For whatever reason, the woman at the table tries to grab Cersei's scepter, her gun.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the homeless guy who's now on her side and helping her, you know, saved all of them, is right there holding a gun. I was very surprised that they didn't have that result in that woman trying to grab the gun, similar to something, an event that might've happened somewhere in north of Chicago, in Wisconsin. Somebody's grabbing a gun, right? And then they end up getting shot as a result. I was kind of surprised that we didn't see that happen, because I know if I were there, you know, holding people at bay for, you know, all right, at 7 a.m., we're no longer, you know, purging each other. So until then, everyone stay cool, be like little Fonzies. If somebody makes that move and tries to grab a gun, I'm sorry, you're getting shot. That is a furtive, aggressive motion that you're doing, threatening the lives of these people who are trying to preserve life. So I think that lady would have been shot if this movie had been more, I don't know, accurate to how real people would have reacted to that.
And justifiably shot, is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. She intended to grab that gun to kill Cersei.
Sure, sure. Now,
she had already been spared once, too. They spared her life once already. It's like she, and because he says, what do you want to do, you know? Do you want me to shoot these people? And they're like, oh, yeah, please just do it quickly. Shoot us, you know? And she's like, no, we're not doing this anymore. So already there, she made clear, I don't want to kill anybody here. And so she spared her life already once. And now she's attempting again to kill her. Yeah, I mean, that was actually kind of, should have just blown her head off right there.
Yeah, I think they just wanted to have that, you know, smash the face down on the table scene for whatever reason. But, you know, you could actually look at it on a more like deeper psychological level. Like that woman said, okay, shoot us, just make it quick. So in her mind, she's already like come to terms with dying. And so now she's like, okay, she's sort of accepted. So now she's got nothing left to lose. She's willing to take that final grasp at the end to, you know, exact this ridiculous revenge of envy for her neighbor for whatever reason.
Yeah, for me, that last scene was just a big kind of cliche that happens in so many movies where the hero, you know, they get to keep and show their true character, their heroic character, by not killing the villain. But then the villain kind of forces the hero to kill them by grabbing the gun. I think we just did the movie called The Postman where that happens at the end. I can't think of all the times it's happened, but it's especially back in the 80s and the 90s, it happened a lot where the hero's just too heroic, too good. And then they're not going to kill them at the end, but then the villain does something and you're forcing the hero's hand or they kill themselves or something like that. I like your take on it, Daniel, that it's very in a real life situation. She was absolutely going for a weapon to do with the intent to do harm. Or even if she wasn't, you don't know what her intentions necessarily were. All you can do is assume that her intentions were to do harm. And all you can do is react with the desire to protect yourself and others. So yeah, absolutely. You blow her away. But it is kind of a cliche where the villain grabs the gun at the end. And I'm kind of glad that they didn't have her get shot, because that's just, it's happened so many times.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's get into final summary and review, and let's score it. I think in the pre-show we were talking about the Electoral College and how many Olafs each state is worth. Florida's worth 29 Olafs. Washington State's worth 12 Olafs. So perhaps we give this a score out of 10 Olafs in honor of the base Swede, the Anarcho-Viking.
Sure. Sounds good. I'll go first. So I like how this is it shows the religiousness of the state, and these characters are very much on board with the how good government has made the world by instituting this one night where the law doesn't apply and somehow morality doesn't apply either. Somehow everybody's a psychopath, and you know, it would not work in real life. There are a million and one reasons why it would not work. The number one being that we are social animals that live in a society together, and we tend to get upset when our friends and loved ones get murdered. So the idea that we would just go, well, he got murdered on the purge, you know, so I'm not upset about it. Or you would wait 364 days before you get your revenge on. It's just all silly and ridiculous, but it is a fun scenario to kind of have the thought experiment about what, you know, what could happen if people were like this. Just don't take any lessons that people are like this, please. I did appreciate that they specifically mentioned when they were talking about the purge happening that night, that as a reminder, the bureaucrats, the government employees are immune from the purge. So you can't go and kill all the government people because of course you can't, because they would be like on the chopping block first thing if the purge was a real thing. We're exempt. I mean, this is a great idea, but we can't be a part of it. We're totally exempt. We can't, you know, what would you do without us? Who would come up with these great ideas? So, yeah, that I thought that was fun. But for $3 million and for like a first time filmmaker, it clearly made a ton of cash, like proportionally for the investment. So that's fantastic. And it spawned a bunch of sequels. I don't know the quality level of those. I know one of them is called Purge Anarchy.
Yeah, probably, best number two.
Probably bad take on anarchy, if I can assume. But yeah, I will give this, you know, because I had more fun at the movie's expense than I legitimately had fun. I think the execution was bad, and we got into that and the reasons why there was no tension, that sort of thing. So I can't give it like a super positive rating, but in a way that it's like a bad movie. Like, it's a bad movie, but it's better than it has a right to be because of the concept. So I'm going to give this 7 masked Olafs out of 10, but it's a low 7. It's more of a 6 than a 7, but I got to give it a 7 for the fun factor that I had and the good discussion that it prompted. So that's my rating.
All right. That's pretty good. I think that we did poke a fair number of holes in it. And again, it's another one that's like a really good concept. I felt like similar to The Postman, really good concept, kind of poor execution. And I sort of blame The Postman on just Kevin Costner taking on too much. That's sort of what we talked about in that episode. On this one, I think, yeah, it's probably related to this is maybe his first effort. And he he knew he had a good concept. He got investors and he started making the movie. And he just missed some of these areas that could have made it a little bit tighter, you know, adding a little bit more tension and adding a little bit more of like interesting things or reasons for things to have happened and have them kind of tie together, which, of course, we can armchair quarterback all day long. But I felt like this was maybe a worthy episode or a movie to do for the election time, because I think that, you know, after having 100 and some odd days of mostly peaceful riots in many major cities in the U.S., we can only imagine what the flashpoint's going to be next Tuesday as a result of whatever ends up happening. So overall, I think it's good premise. Bit of a sloppy execution, could have been a little bit tighter. I think that at least the sequel, it actually got more favorable reviews than this one, which is a bit surprising because I liked this first one better. I have not seen the third one in the installment, which is called Election Night, or the fourth one, which is called The First Purge, which, so it's a bit of a prequel. And then the one coming out next year is, I believe, titled Purge Forever. So anyway, it did enough to spawn off sequels and make a bunch of money. So good on them for that. And it was a very interesting discussion. I'm really glad that we had Olaf on for tonight. And I will give it 6 unmasked Olafs for my rating. And we'll go over to Olaf for his rating and review. Number of yourselves, please, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to give it the lowest so far. I'm gonna give it 5. And some of them might even wear masks. I don't know, because it was a little bit, yeah. Anyway, no, I think the cool stuff in the movie that you can, it's because it's not a new concept. I do recognize some of this, you know, from like the Hunger Games, where they play on the same, they refer back to this ancient, almost human practice, this religious sacrifice that been going on for a very long time throughout human history to pacify the population. They need this thing to occur to pacify whatever gods they have and to not create too much tension. So they organize all these types of events where there's religious or animal sacrifice and these kind of weird stuff, uncontrolled kind of chaotic events to occur to control their, these animalistic instincts almost in the population. So those, that part was very interesting to witness. I think where the weak stuff is, I think it, the plot is very simplistic, is highly predictable. Some of the things going on in kind of, yeah, I know it's a low budget setting and everything, but I thought that it was, the plot did not satisfy. It appeals to a very kind of lower spectrum of the IQ in the population, I think. And but yeah, no, as you said, and that what Robert said about, and that we forgot to discuss, and that I now remember, was, you know, the announcement that the, you know, the state bureaucrats there are exempt from this, like of course. What do you do with these people, you know? That's this is like, those would have been the ones that have been tarred and feathered before everybody else. And with regards to what's going on right now on the streets in many of the cities, you know, we have to remember what Rothbard wrote about a strategy for the right, and what Hans Hermann Hoppe then, you know, extrapolate from, and you know, provides further explanation for what the strategy ought to be for the right to remove these elements from society physically. So yeah, no, there are definitely material in there that you can reference to and look at what's going on today also. So it was an interesting movie to talk about in this day, like in this moment, in the moment that we are living in. But I don't think it was a good movie. Like, also an interesting fact about it was, you know, I had never heard the word lockdown before the pandemic, and it just came back in this movie, and this was like years ago. It's like a lockdown. Oh, well, that's interesting. You know, I'd never even heard that term before. So kind of like almost a little bit of PTSD. Yeah. No, I give it a 5. I can't, I don't think I did not. I thought it was, you know, it almost was a parody of itself. It was supposed to be like a horror movie. Like I found that I was laughing more than like kind of, you know, and being scared in a controlled environment by it. That's how I wanted to be. And with a horror movie, I would like the really, you know, The Shining or The Exorcist and those movies, when you kind of like can really feel kind of this fear in a controlled environment. This became more almost like a comedy thing, yeah, to a certain extent.
Yeah, I'd agree with a lot of what you're saying, and we'll of course have some of that Rothbard and Hoppe stuff on the show notes page at what is this, lastnighters.com/148. And then just so you guys are aware, and I haven't seen it, but apparently Purge Election Year, the third one in the series, they remove the bureaucrats of level 10 or higher are no longer exempt. And it's because there's somebody running for president who is, I think his platform is on turning off the purge or preventing the purge, something like that. So those with interest in maintaining the purge make this change so that he might be assassinated and not threaten the system. So, you know, another decent concept, but probably not a good movie. Again, I haven't seen it, but it is kind of an interesting little alteration in the purge announcement and rules that they have to protect themselves, basically.
Indeed. Well, I hope, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't sound like the concepts got a whole lot more radically, you know, sophisticated. I mean, he's playing with some similar elements here, but I would hope that in the sequels, they improve the action and the drama, especially the action. The action was like kind of hard to follow what's happening. When there's a flashlight, you can kind of see what's happening. But if I don't see, I don't understand, you know, I know the sum of the stakes, like if I cared about the characters, okay. But you also need to know the threat and understand the precarious position that the character's in order to have tension. And if it's just all a bunch of flashlights moving around and body parts and stuff, you're just like, what's happening? Am I supposed to feel something right now? I don't know. So hopefully that's improved. But it seems like these people like to make these kind of horror slasher type movies. And I don't know, high concept horror slasher.
Yeah.
There's something for everybody, I guess.
You know, I guess the final thing I'd add on this is, In the first one and the second one, they present the purgers or the villains of the film as almost in a creepy, like almost metaphysical way. Like they're like ethereal in a way, at least initially. This was the same in the first movie and in the second one, where there's all these like jump cuts to the security footage and they're like on the swing and then the swing's moved and then they're off the swing, or there's like people in the yard and then they're not in the yard, that kind of a thing. They do a similar thing in the second one where there's this like group with a van and motorcycles chasing these people, and they just happen to like show up all over the place, just around every corner. Like it's almost in a like a creepy, like, how are they doing this kind of a way. But then by the end of the movie, it's like, oh, he's just a guy trying to sell them to the rich people, you know? And it's just like, eh, okay. So he's not mystical. Well, that kind of falls flat then. Anyway, another concept that's like not well executed, and I think that's sort of the MO for what we see here. High concept, not great on the execution, and missed opportunities. That's the other thing. You when you're watching, you're like, oh, I want this to happen. And then you see what they do and you're like, all right, well, okay. It could have been so much better. It, like Olav was saying, there was a lot of predictability going on here that they could have played with probably a bit. And here I am criticizing people who make shit. I don't make shit. All I can do is fucking shit on inward singing. I don't create. Anyway. Well, anyway, Olav, it's been a great time having you on again. I hope you can stick around for just a little bit longer. I know it's late for you, but we do the Kathleen Turnover Dive, which is bonus content for the Patreon people. So lastnarrows.com/Patreon, everyone. And do throw a review our way and just, you know, lambast us, whatever you want. We'll read it on air in a future upcoming episode. Put a name on there that you're willing to have us say, and we'll roast you back. You know, we'll take your criticism and we'll reply in real time. It'll be great. So do that over on our iTunes or wherever else that kind of thing goes. And next week we're going to be, it's hard to believe because we're recording this near the end of October, but it's going to be after Halloween. It's going to be after the election. It's going to be right before what's now called Veterans Day, but I like to think of as Armistice Day. So we're going to be doing another war movie with a foreign policy expert, Kyle Anselone of the Libertarian Institute. He was on with us a couple of years ago for the Brad Pitt movie, War Machine. And this next episode is going to be a listener suggested movie called Beast of War, I think. The Beast of War. It's about the Russians fighting the Afghanis, the Mujahideen, who are the good guys. And it's this tank that is, you know, attacking them. And it's like the story of these Russian guys. And apparently it's one of Quentin Tarantino's writing partners, like favorite movies. It's very unknown. It didn't get a lot of play, but it's apparently really well done. I have not seen it yet, but it is available on Amazon Prime. So Kyle Anselone will be on for that next week's Beast of War. I will have a link to that on our show notes page as well. So that'll be at lastnarrows.com/148. And of course you can find Olaf's previous appearances there, the Rothbard and Hoppe articles that we were talking about. And we look forward to having Kyle on next week. And thanks a lot for being our guest, Olaf. We'd love to have you back again, maybe in a couple of months, and with a movie that you've seen and want to do. Of course, when I asked you on for this, you hadn't seen it, but I'm glad that you're willing to watch it and then come on and talk about it. We had a really great discussion with you. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. So Robert, any final words for our audience before we get into that Kathleen Turnover Drive? What can people do? When can they expect to hear the second episode of Robert's Rants?
I didn't even know there was going to be a first episode, Daniel. So who knows, man? You ask me a question and then you don't interject for about 5 minutes and I'll just rant about something. But it would be nice if you could get me fired up, you know, before I make it be something personal to me or something I'm really passionate about. But I don't think you have a problem doing that. So you can expect that in the near future. You can support us at patreon.com/lastnighters. You can go to trepster.com and buy some merch. You could just tell your friends, do a review like Daniel was talking about. Roast us if you like. If you totally disagree with any aspect, if you think we're ugly, if you think we smell, if you think we, who knows? I don't know. If you just disagree with us in any way or even just want to be funny, that'd be fantastic. But anyway, we'll be back next week with the Beast of War or something like that. the title. I'm not exactly sure, but yeah, it's supposed to be really, really good.
Yeah, The Beast of War, I believe, is the title, and I will make sure to have that on the show notes page just in case I'm wrong, but I'm looking forward to that, and we will get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. So with that, I'll say safe night, everyone, and good night from last night. Peace out. All right, and we're still on the Actual Anarchy podcast for just a few more minutes. We went pretty long on this one already, so I'm going to keep this kind of short. But there was one question, Robert and Olaf, that I have, and that is related to the boyfriend coming in and like trying to kill the dad. Even though it's Purge Night, if we accept the premise that this is an okay thing to do, even though it's like totally immoral, and you know, we talked about all the legality doesn't mean shit kind of thing. But wouldn't you think that if this guy kills her dad, the daughter's dad, she's not going to want to have anything to do with him. And beyond that, even though it was Purge Night, like clearly Ethan Hawke was shooting him in self-defense. So even if it was a totally like government sanctioned thing, obviously he was in the right in shooting in defense and killing the boyfriend. But what was going on in this guy's head? Is it just a stupid, late teenager, early 20s, dumb thing to do to, well, if he's going to forbid you to see me, then I'm going to take matters in my own hands and kill him. And that'll solve it. Like, what the hell, man?
Yeah. I mean, I think there is kind of precedent for it. Like, I don't know how, if it's a long time ago, like in Middle Ages and whatnot, or before that, where you would challenge like the father to a duel or something, and then they would actually fight. You know, I don't necessarily know you're trying to kill him, but you're more like kind of earning his respect as a man, that kind of thing. Like,
this is more like an ambush. Like,
this is a lot more like an ambush. Yes. This is more like, I know how to get her wet. I'm going to kill her dad. This is a great idea. Smart.
He also got into the house.
Bedtime secrets.
Before the lockdown too, right? I mean, he broke into, he trespassed into the house.
Certainly.
The starting point. So he was cheating to begin with. That's that's terrible. Yeah. So I don't know. It seems like the daughter had very strenuous relationship with her dad. Maybe she even hated her dad to some extent. But yeah, that's some sick stuff. I don't know I'm not sure. That just seemed like. But again, like, we knew that he was going to die there. Like, you cannot wipe out the main character. So we knew that, you know, Sandy wasn't going to die. It was this guy that was going to be dead, which was highly predictable. So, yeah.
I still think from a screenwriting perspective, I think it would have been more interesting if they had kept the boyfriend alive.
Yeah.
And have there be like that tension for the rest of the movie, which they ended up having with the homeless guy.
Yeah.
But it would have been like another unreliable actor inside the house. That's a potential turncoat. You don't know what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe Ethan Hawke is just like, well, I'm going to tie him up, lock him in a room or whatever. But then, you know, he escapes and maybe the girlfriend like helps him escape or something like that. And then there would have been like a separate factions going on, kind of like a Survivor Island situation. I don't know, but, I think he had something going there. It was weird to have him just die off immediately. Like, they introduce him and then like a minute later, he's dead. Like, we know he's in the house. Oh, and he's dead. It was really kind of a weird thing from a storytelling perspective to even have. Like, if you're going to kill him off just instantly, what was the point of that? You know, otherwise, if you're going to set something up, play with it. Have him be a thorn in Ethan Hawke's side. Have him be, you know, question him, you know, like, I don't know if I can trust this kid or not because he just tried to kill me. It seemed like a waste, another wasted opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. I like where you're going with this. And he could have like maybe earned the respect of Ethan Hawke by the end somehow, maybe by dying or sacrificing himself or, you know, being heroic in some way.
Exactly. You could have had him survive at the end and being like, And then he, as Ethan Hawke's dying, he's like, okay, you can be with my daughter, or, you know, something like a better line than that, obviously, but, you know.
All right. So we're going to do our homage. We're going to do fan fiction version of The Purge and just take the concept and make it that much better. But like with stop motion animation or Legos or something.
Awesome.
I'm just kidding. I don't know how to do any of that shit.
I was like, what?
But we do know how to criticize things.
That's right. That's all we do here. That's the point of our show. Well, Olaf, thanks again for sticking around a little bit longer for the actual Anarchy portion of the show. We can have a little bit of bonus content for the Patreons right after this. Episode is actualanarchy.com/205 for show notes and more. We'll have all of your prior appearances, the Rothbard and Hoppian articles, and we'll have Anselone on for the Beast of War next week for our Armistice Day episode. Any final things you'd like to throw out to the audience there, Olaf?
No, I think we got everything in. It's exhausted the material for this movie. This was a pretty short one too, so you know, it wasn't that hard to watch either. It wasn't hard to follow or anything like that. I would actually suggest people watch it because it's pretty interesting with regards to what's going on today.
Yeah, yeah, watch and it and then come back. Very easy.
You can even kind of like half watch it a little bit. Like you know what's going on. It's not hard to follow. It's very easy to understand what's going on.
All right. Well, you heard it here, folks, the five Olafs lukewarm recommendation to half watch this movie and then listen to our episode. So thanks again for joining us. And we will get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive right after this. And I wish you safe night and maximum freedom, everyone. Peace out.
Chipmunks. CHIPMUNK. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.